When we praise the work of William Shakespeare, how much do we know about the man and his work? For that matter, is it his work? These are the questions raised a fair amount in the 4 centuries since the listed death date of William Shakespeare. The questions fall under the main issue frequently called the Shakespeare authorship question. The Oxfordians, people who believe that the 17th century Earl of Oxford wrote the works attributed to Shakespeare, gather in Ashland for a weekend conference, and they'll also view some of the plays at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which perhaps needs a different name. Our guests today, one of whom is not an Oxfordian, so we'll start with her, is Roz Barber. She's an English lecturer at Goldsmiths, the University of London, and director of research and webmaster at the Shakespearean Authorship Trust. Roz, welcome to you.
Hi, Jeff.
We also have Kevin Gilvary with us. He is the chair of the De Vere Society. He received his doctorate at Brunel University in London with a thesis on Shakespeare biographiction. Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin.
It's good to be here, Jeff.
Alexander Waugh is with us as well. He's the author of several books, the editor of many more, the honorary president of the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, and co-editor of Shakespeare Beyond Doubt, Exposing an Industry in Denial. Alexander Waugh, thank you for coming as well.
My pleasure.
So, first of all, the meeting that goes on, is this an annual conference that is held to discuss the Shakespeare authorship question?
Well, that's right, Jeff. It's been going on for about 30 years now, and it's held in different parts of the States, and about every 5 years it comes back to Ashland so that we can all enjoy the wonderful plays that are put on at the theatre here.
The wonderful plays, but we're not quite sure who wrote them?
Well, one thing that we're all agreed on is that the plays and the works are absolutely wonderful. They are top-notch, and we really do think that the more people can come along and appreciate them, either in performance or by reading them, then that's the better.
It appears, just in reading your own individual biographies, that the different names of the organizations you represent, I mean, it sounds like there are many organizations devoted to dealing with the authorship question.
There are various organizations, and we enjoy cordial relationships between us. In England, we've got the De Vere Society, so we believe that Oxford was the real author of the plays. There's an umbrella organization called the Shakespearean Authorship Trust, of which also I'm a member, and so is Roz. And that just allows people to air discussion about the authorship, which is generally frowned upon in other circles. In America, the main group are the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, of which I'm a member as well. So we enjoy good relations.
So let's get from each of you a little description of how you got into this in the first place. And so, Alexander, let's move to you.
The best way to get into the Shakespeare authorship question is by reading a conventional book on Shakespeare. And if you read any standard biography of Shakespeare, you realise it's full of holes and nonsense and rubbish. We're essentially told that someone came from the British Midlands in a time when 80% of the community was illiterate, that he came without any recorded evidence of education, either at school or at university. He may have gone to the Stratford Grammar School, but we don't know it. We're told that he then left his children and wife behind, turned up in London, and suddenly started writing all the greatest plays that have ever been written in the history of mankind. Not only the greatest plays, but he's rewriting essentially the whole history of England. And yet nobody seems to know him. Nobody's met him. He himself doesn't say, I'm a great playwright. Nobody else says this guy is a playwright. His family doesn't say he's a poet or a playwright. As far as we can see, he probably can't write. Now, we know for absolute certain that his parents couldn't write. His two daughters, one of them called Judith, signs her name with a cross. The other one can't recognise her husband's handwriting, so it looks very much as though there's a lot of illiteracy going on in that family. And we, at this time, we have to start saying, well, this is the same playwright who wrote of Prospero educating his daughter. We just don't buy it. So that's the best way to get into the authorship question is read a really good standard orthodox biography, and you'll start realising it's full of holes and it needs some reason to be pumped into it. And then, of course, you can start investigating who you think did write it.
Did each of you start with the standard story that William Shakespeare was the author, and then have your eyes widened by reading something like what Alexander was just talking about?
I can't speak for Kevin, but certainly I was raised on the standard story. I did a module at university just on Shakespeare. We did Shakespeare at school. I never had any particular reason to doubt it. I wasn't enormously interested, I hadn't really been exposed to the authorship question. And then I watched a documentary by the Australian filmmaker Mike Ribot in 2005. It was already old then, called Much Ado About Something, which was floating the idea that Christopher Marlowe might have been the author of the works. And it really piqued my interest. And at the time I was casting around for an idea for a creative writing PhD, and Jonathan Bate, a well-known Shakespearean scholar, interviewed on the programme, said, well, it's a ludicrous idea, but it would make a great novel. And I thought, great, that's I'll do that then. But when I actually started researching the novel, I became fascinated by the question and realised that there are really good evidential reasons for the question's existence. It's been around for 150 years and with good reason, because there isn't the supporting evidence for the orthodox candidate.
You had mentioned when I was describing this group as Oxfordians that you're not an Oxfordian. So do you leave? Are you more of an agnostic?
I am more of an agnostic. And in fact, I think that the authorship question is two questions. One is, did Shakespeare of Stratford write the works attributed to him? When that chair is vacated, which, you know, is, well, shall it happen? I'm pretty sure it will happen at some point. But once that's out of the way, then I think for me, that's the time to start looking at who did. I mean, there are plenty. I've read a great deal of Oxfordian literature, Baconian, you know, people who think Francis Bacon wrote the works, and there are a number of other candidates. I like Marlowe, but I wrote my novel on the sort of Marlowe theory, so I'm quite deeply ensconced in that one. But I'm not. I wouldn't say I believe that, you know, Marlowe wrote the works. I think that I'd like to see some hard evidence. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no hard evidence either way.
No evidence that Shakespeare did it. No evidence that Marlowe did it.
Well, you know, everything is circumstantial. But the problem with the orthodox case, the case of Shakespeare of Stratford, is it shouldn't be circumstantial with him. We should have some hard evidence. Someone should have been able to connect him to the plays in his lifetime.
Which we do have for practically every other writer at the time.
Okay.
So if you go for a list of all the writers at that time and say, have we got hard evidence that they were the people writing these things, and your one's going to writers people have hardly ever heard of, and the answer is yes. Shakespeare stands out for having no evidence.
Okay, let's pick that up on the other side of a break. We're talking about the Shakespeare authorship question with Alexander, Kevin, and Roz back on the Jefferson Exchange, with them and your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the Shakespeare authorship question today. Did William Shakespeare write the plays that are generally attributed to him? Was there a William Shakespeare? If he's not the one who wrote the plays, then who did? These are questions considered this weekend as a number of people consider the Shakespeare authorship question. And their annual conference is being held in Ashland this weekend. We have three of the attendees in the studio with us. Alexander Waugh from the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, Kevin Gilvary from the DeVere Society, and Roz Barber from the Shakespearean Authorship Trust. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Alexander, I want to follow up on the point you made just before the break, which was about the records and essentially the paper trail, because that's one of the major questions. It's like, okay, well, it doesn't seem to exist for Shakespeare, but given fires and movings of governments and changes in governments, for England has been through several revolutions since that time, what is the likelihood that you'll find a paper trail on anyone? And it sounds like you do have it for other people.
Well, so there's a scholar called Diana Price, and she looked into this specifically, and she took, I think it was 24, but actually you can well go up to 30 or 35 contemporary authors to find if there was what she called a literary paper trail. And she found it for all of them. Sometimes people like Ben Jonson, who's a contemporary, there were hundreds of reasons you could see why he was the author, and there was no doubt about it. Shakespeare was outstanding about that. Now, what's also quite interesting is nobody even suggested that Shakespeare of Stratford wrote anything until a good 7 years after he died. All of the evidence upon which this is based seems to come from one source, and that one source is Ben Jonson, who, it appears, edited something called The First Folio, which is the first big book of plays that came out in 1623 of Shakespeare's plays, and he put 8 pages of material together at the front. And he doesn't say that this guy wrote the plays, but he allows what he called those of silliest ignorance to sort of waft off in that direction. He also made it very clear that anyone who's concentrating with a tiny bit of intelligence, he's not actually saying what he thinks he's saying. He's being very ambiguous and making some good jokes. After 1623, nobody believed that Shakespeare of Stratford was writing. Nobody believed it before. If you look at the allusions to Shakespeare pre-1623, all of them suggest it's a pseudonym, every single one of them. And we're told by conventional scholars, oh, this is a rather cryptic remark about Shakespeare. Why? They don't tell us why we're being cryptic. And all it's saying is Shakespeare's a jolly good fellow and he's becoming famous. That's what you're told these things mean. But if you look for 10 seconds at every single reference to Shakespeare, there aren't that many, but every single reference to Shakespeare before 1623, you can see that everybody's saying, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, it's a pseudonym. And it's really quite obvious when you sit down and concentrate on them.
Yeah, which explains this question down here. Was this a nudge, nudge, wink, wink sort of thing? So we seem to agree.
The whole game is nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and that's why it's great fun. If you get involved in the Shakespeare authorship, there's quite a lot of, there's lots of different anti-Stratfordians, but some are really going through the historical records, some are looking at the literary records and seeing how they hint and joke, there's games and plenty of fun for everyone who gets involved with this, and it's a deep and exciting and terrific mystery.
Does anybody hold an opinion about why there would have been a pseudonym? I mean, were there reasons why other people would not have wanted to come forward and claim the work as their own?
Do you want to speak, Kevin? Go ahead.
Hello, yes. In fact, you asked a question earlier, and my answer to that will lead into your latest question. Certainly in England, we're all brought up as Stratfordians. We're all brought up to believe in this myth from Stratford. As a boy, I was taken up to Stratford and introduced to the theatre and had a wonderful time. And I still go up there and I love it. So it's a fantastic place. But it was after I became an English teacher and I was teaching Henry V, one of my students said, "Who wrote this then? This is all royalist propaganda. Look at how wonderful Henry is. He's the great king." And you get these Bardolph and Peto's and they're just virtually nothing. And this is not sort of aiming at people in the ordinary theatre. This is aimed at aristocrats and royalty. So I responded with, well, of course we know who wrote it. I did this sort of standard response. But in the same way as Ros's interest was piqued, so was mine. And I began to look at this. And when I looked at the accounts of Shakespeare's life, I began to find out, well, he might have done this and he could have done that and perhaps he did something else. And I was thinking, well, where is the hard evidence? Where is the actual base for any of these statements that any of these people are making? And one of the things that I felt emerged was that the plays, especially the history plays, are propaganda and that they are supporting the Tudor regime. It's impossible that the author of Richard II was not known to the authorities, because this was a play put on the night before the Essex Revolution. And when they called in, people say, well, why was this put on? Gilly Merrick, you paid for it, so off you go, hanged, drawn and quartered. But the man who'd actually written it isn't even mentioned in any of the responses. So I really do think that they are propagandistic, and I think therefore they've got a front man. Richard II, as a person at the beginning of the play, he's not very good, he's a bit ineffective, and perhaps he deserves to be deposed. But by the end of the play, we change our mind and we think, oh, this is a bad idea. Now, Elizabeth, at the time, had refused. She deliberately said, nobody can talk about the deposition of Richard II because she was afraid that it might happen to herself. So if a playwright's doing it, but he's giving this spin that it turned out to be badly, then I think that there is a need of a front man to sort of cover this propaganda element. So I go for a front man theory, and that the name William Shakespeare is very similar to the name Shakespeare. I think we need to distinguish the man from Stratford from the name we associate with the works, and that they used his name to mask the real identity. I think Marlowe's a candidate. I certainly think that he's involved in it. But my preferred candidate is Oxford at the moment.
All right. So what is square one of the Oxfordian argument?
His life and his outlook sort of matches the outlook and life in many different ways presented in the plays. So he was an acclaimed poet. He was an acclaimed author. He'd been to Italy. He travelled around there for 15 months. He came back. And as we know, many of the plays are set in Italy. They draw on a lot of Italian sources. They follow the Commedia dell'arte. And so we see that there's a very strong fit. And if you look at something like Hamlet, which is Shakespeare's greatest play, it's almost exactly the situation that the Earl of Oxford found himself in at the age of 20 or so. He's brought up as a ward of court. His father's died in strange circumstances. He's attracted to the daughter of the councillor, whom he's forced to marry in the end. And it's uncanny how many coincidences there are. But as Rod says, it is a circumstantial case. It's something that we'd like to investigate further and find real hard evidence. But there's certainly a much better circumstantial case for the Earl of Oxford or for Marlowe than there is for William Shakespeare of Stratford.
So explain that, if you would, the difference between the Man of Stratford and William Shakespeare.
Well, the Man of Stratford has got a documented life. He was born in 1564, he's baptised. We don't know anything until he's married at the age of 18, then he's cited as his father, and then he turns up in London at the age of 30. So there's, you know, we talk about the lost years. There's about 30 years which are actually lost. Then he seems to be involved in the theatre, and he's involved in the movement from the theatre and the north side of the Thames to the Globe. And so he's certainly in the picture there. We think that his name, he's pulled out as to say, hang on a second, you go and take the plaudits for this.
Hang on, not we think, you think.
All right. right. There's a difference of opinion on that one.
Yes.
And then he became very, very rich. He bought some property worth £320. Now, £6 a play, that would take about 53 and a third plays for him to just buy that property alone. He didn't get rich from writing plays. But I think he got rich in other ways.
Well, there is some evidence that Shakespeare was involved in some sort of had his money invested or something.
He became a very rich man, and he bought the second largest house in Stratford for £60. He bought this property that involves pasture at £320. He bought some tithes, so this was the income that previously had gone to the church, for £440. So he's become a very affluent person with no visible means of income, and certainly not from the kind of activity as a playwright. His income came from somewhere else, and some of us, I'm not sure if Alexander will agree or Ros will disagree, but some of us believe that he's there, he's working as a bit of a lackey, and he's taking money from the Earl of Oxford.
Are there works in Oxford's name, his own works that survive that appear stylistically to be similar?
There are absolutely. There are a lot of short poems which are juvenilia, and they occur in manuscripts, and they are very interesting. And a lot of people say, well, they're not very good. Isn't it a shame when you make your case so much better? But there was an American called Louis Benezet who spliced together some of those poems of Oxford with the poems of Shakespeare. And if you hand this out to somebody and say, right, well, Oxford's poetry isn't very good, go and tell me which lines aren't very good, belong to Oxford, and which lines belong to Shakespeare, nobody can do it. And you say, well, this is it. He's writing in the same form, iambic pentameter, very often in couplets there, and it's very similar sentiments. So, yes, there is a strong coincidence.
We are talking about the Shakespeare authorship question here on the Jefferson Exchange, as a number of people, about 100 people from various parts of the world, have come to Ashland for their annual conference to talk about the Shakespeare authorship question. They include Kevin Vilveri, who you just heard, is the chair of the De Vere Society. Alexander Wall, you've heard as well. He's the honorary president of the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition. And Ros Barber is with the Shakespearean Authorship Trust. You can join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 around the region. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Ros, just in terms of conspiracy theories, I don't know if this has been raised as that sort of thing. I mean, are the people looking for somebody other than Shakespeare to write Shakespeare's plays along the lines of people looking for the second shooter at JFK's assassination or something along those lines?
I'm really glad you brought that question to me, Jeff, because I have real issue with the term conspiracy theory, because conspiracy theory is just a derogatory term that it's only really surfaced in the last sort of 15 years or 20 years. And what it is to try and say sort of, let's just dismiss this as something that's not even worth looking at, because this is clearly nuts.
Makes a crackpot-y
right.
sounding.
Now, yes, indeed. And, you know, but actually, my interest is in the idea of Shakespeare as a broker. And the way that I'm approaching this is that, you know, all the records that we have for William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon is that he was a successful middleman. He bought and sold grain. He bought and sold tithes. He was a broker in a marriage. He negotiated a marriage. And he's obviously very good in that kind of middleman role. You know, and essentially, if you came at him, you know, if he was called John Smith and a neutral historian came and looked at all the records that you had for him and you said, well, to the historian, he said, what do you think this man did for a living? They would say, well, he's a businessman. He's a broker. He does deals. That's what he does. Once he gets involved in the theatre and becomes a shareholder, so he becomes a shareholder in the Lord Chamberlain's Men and then later the King's Men, and he's a shareholder in the Globe Theatre. Clearly, once he's involved in theatre, the most obvious thing for him to do is use his strengths as a middleman there, because the company needed to buy in plays. And they also sold plays once they owned them to the publishers. Now, one of the big arguments that people make for Shakespeare of Stratford being the author of the plays attributed to him is that his name is on the plays. But his name is also, and initials, also on 7 plays published during his lifetime that he did not write. That we know he did not write, and in some of those cases we know who did write them. And the obvious reason why that would occur is because he's in a position as the play broker of the company to sell them to publishers at a time when, for the first time, they were putting a name on plays. Now, we know from Henslowe's diary that the majority of plays at the time were collaboratively written. We know that Henslowe was often paying 4 or 5 writers for a play. Once they started to be published with a name on, they're trying to publish them as literature. And when they're publishing them as literature, they want a single name or at most 2 names. And despite the majority of those plays at the, you know, in this period being co-authored, when they're published, around 90% of those plays are published with only 1 name on. And he is in the position to put his name on. When they say, well, we only want 1 name. So he puts his name on. The first plays published, that they say that they're amended and corrected by WS. Gradually, it becomes written by William Shakespeare. So, you know, I'm kind of interested in that as a sort of broker theory. So I see what we now look at, all the evidence that we have that has caused the authorship question, to be an actual sort of natural result of normal Elizabethan publishing practices. What was actually happening at the time would explain why we don't have anything connecting him directly to the writing of plays, but that he was involved in the business of theatre.
In this sense, then, he sounds like William Shakespeare, the brand, almost like Walt Disney collecting a stable of creative people under him.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have an artist, Damien Hirst, in the UK. We know he has a stable of people working for him. He comes up with an idea. They make the work. And then it goes out as a Damien Hirst. So I see it as a kind of branding exercise very early. And in fact, if you look at the first folio, that's a massive branding thing by the King's Men as they were then. And then later, the King's Men brought out another folio of Francis Beaumont. It's Beaumont and Fletcher, John Fletcher and Beaumont. And it's down as the works of Beaumont and Fletcher. And now scholars are looking at it and they're saying the majority of these plays are not by Beaumont and Fletcher. Some of them are by Beaumont. Some of them are by Fletcher. I think only about 5 in the sort of 30-something plays are actually by Beaumont and Fletcher. There's several other writers, about 7 other writers that they now reckon wrote these plays. So this is the King's Men branding Beaumont and Fletcher. But they'd done it earlier, in my view, with the folio of William Shakespeare. This was the Shakespeare brand. It was a successful brand.
And what do you see as some of the holes in the Oxfordian argument? Because you do not buy that it's necessarily Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford.
Well, I'm open to the Oxfordian theory. I'm kind of, at the moment, I'm just interested in, you know, trying to make a case for the authorship question being a valid question. That's the most important thing as far as I'm concerned. And I think that we obviously have differences of opinion on who our preferred candidates are and slightly different theories, just as on the orthodox side, you know, there's always academic arguments between people there. But I think the most important thing is to question the orthodoxy that it was Shakespeare of Stratford who wrote these plays. Because at the moment, I mean, I got the PhD in the authorship question, but only I was only able to do that at the university where I was at because I was writing a novel and because it was research for a novel. And they actually said that to me, you would never be allowed to study this if you weren't just writing a work of fiction. So I kind of slipped it under the radar by writing this work of fiction.
Can I just say the same thing happened to me? I've just completed my PhD at Brunel University in London, and this was on Shakespearean biograph fiction. So I was showing that the biographies that are written are largely fiction. So I think fictional biographies are a bit of an oxymoron, sort of like dedicated student or military intelligence. Sorry, that was just
caffeine
a joke.
Free coffee.
all I wanted to demonstrate was that the things that people were saying about Shakespeare were just not founded in evidence. They were just things which were sort of occurring to them, and they have this sort of glorious idea of what he must have been like without any real basis, as Alexander described. So my examiners came along and they said, "This is fantastic, great, we're really sort of surprised about this, but we're very pleased when you came to the conclusion you didn't say, therefore it must have been the Earl of Oxford." And I just kept myself very quiet on that one. I thought, I'm not going to bite, because I kept authorship out of my thesis. And I think that if you read my thesis or the outline of it, then it's a very small step to say, well, if all that they're saying is not true, or at least unevidenced, undocumented, then what do we know, and what can we say about it? And it's only a small step from there to then question the authorship. But as Rod says, I had to keep it out because it's not acceptable in academic circles in Britain to talk about authorship.
Really?
Yeah, it's absolutely taboo.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you get a more receptive audience in America?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's quite a strong current of doubt in both countries, but that in academia, it's very strong that you don't cast aspersions as it's considered. I mean, we're not casting aspersions on the author. We just think the author might be somebody else. You know, we all really admire the works of Shakespeare. That's why we get so passionate about it. But it's still, I think it's very problematic. I don't think academia in the US is that different from academia in the UK. I think that the authorship question is taboo. It's an academic taboo.
Well, just to agree with that, in Oxford University, until I think about 1871, a fellow, that means a lecturer, had to be a member of the Church of England. And this is almost like the same kind of religious orthodoxy.
Oh, happy to belong to the orthodoxy, yes, indeed. Okay, much more to talk about with the Shakespeare authorship question with Kevin Gilvary, Roz Barber, and Alexander Waugh back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are discussing the Shakespeare authorship question here on the Exchange today regarding whether or not William Shakespeare actually was the author of all those plays that he is given credit for in our time. The folks of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship are meeting in Ashland this weekend for 4 days of discussions and arguments and debates and, I don't know, fist fights or something too, perhaps. We'll check that with our guests in just a moment. They'll also be delivering an Ollie lecture this afternoon at the First Presbyterian Church in Ashland from 1 to 3 about the very same subject matter. Our guests in the studio, Alexander Waugh, the honorary president of the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition. Kevin Gilvary is the chair of the De Vere Society. Edward De Vere, the Earl of Oxford, being the suspected author of the plays, and Roz Barber is with the Shakespearean Authorship Trust. You can join our discussion on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. One of you mentioned that the discussion, the Shakespeare authorship question, first cropped up about 150 years ago. Was that? And I read something about that might have been along the lines of someone who had gotten bristling about people questioning the existence of Jesus at one point in history.
Could I clarify this?
Sure.
a little bit? As I said to you earlier, if you look at the early records and the early discussions of Shakespeare, everyone's going nudge, nudge, wink, wink, this is a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. Then Shakespeare of Stratford dies. 7 years later, you get nudge, nudge, wink, wink, Sweet Swan of Avon, for instance. Ooh, that must mean Stratford-upon-Avon. Ooh. But as I say, you don't have to go in that direction. These people talked in double tongue the whole time. In fact, Avon was a perfectly acceptable old term for Hampton Court, where the Great Theatre was, etc., etc. So you're still not being told that this was the man who wrote them. The evidence then following that continues to cast doubt upon it. In fact, we get one friend of Ben Jonson's in 1636 who calls Shakespeare that English earl who loved a play and a player. Now, I will give you any listener out there, I'll give them £1,000 in used cash if they can find me, if they can find me an orthodox biography of Shakespeare that uses this quotation and discusses it at all. That is swept right under the carpet. Equally, we get another poet called William Davenant who talks about Shakespeare, and he says, if you go up to Avon, your eyes will be mocked, he says, if you go try and find anything to do with the real Shakespeare up in Stratford-upon-Avon. So, again, nobody's really believing it. Now, if you know about English history, what then happens is the sort of Puritan Commonwealth government of Oliver Cromwell comes into power, and they close down the theatres, which they consider immoral and awful. And this goes on for a whole generation, from 1642 until 1660. During that period, everybody is trying to say, we want our theatres back. Well, everybody. I mean, the actors, the people who are involved in the theatre industry, they want their theatres back. And they are campaigning to the stiff Puritan government to say, please, can we have our theatres back? They are not going to say, one of the reasons we want our theatres back is because this guy called William Shakespeare was actually a pseudonym for the 17th Earl of Oxford, was immensely popular with Queen Elizabeth and James and King Charles, because these people are anti-royalists. So I think then, if you're going to say conspiracy theory, I mean, I don't think there's a single conspiracy until we're talking really about that period, long after Shakespeare of Stratford dies, when it becomes useful to have a man of the people who can be represented as Shakespeare. So then it enters the so-called mythos. Then, of course, the eventually 1660, the theatres come back. And this isn't the age of biography. Nobody writes biographies in those days. So theatres are allowed back. What have we got? Oh, we got this big book saying William Shakespeare. Okay, well, let's put some of him in. God, aren't they brilliant? It's not really for another 120 years before anyone actually sits down to write a proper biography of this man, by which time it's too late and the myth has taken off.
And Kevin Gilvary, you want to get in?
Can I just add into there, the first actual full-length biography of Shakespeare was not until 1843. It's Charles Knight. It was about 500 pages, and it's got things like his mother used to sing him to sleep with all the lullabies that she'd learned in her youth. And when he was a young boy...
I'm guessing by the tone of your voice, you don't quite buy this.
His father returned from London with the latest books, and the avid William just read it cover to cover before he went to bed that night. And none of this is actually documented because there are so few documents about William of Stratford. But in 1843, they came up with this idealised view. It was about the time that the Victorians were inventing childhood. You've got Charles Dickens with Christmas Carol and Tiny Tim. And it's in response to that, in the 1840s, that the authorship question really develops. It's when people say, look, this is ridiculous, this is farcical, this just doesn't make any sense. And so Delia Bacon, who's dismissed, isn't it sad that she got mad? She's dismissed for madness, simply because she questioned whether any of these sort of myths that had been sort of brewing up and then all brought together in a 540-page biography of Shakespeare were true, and whether this was really valid or not. So that's where the first biography came out, and that's when the first serious doubts were raised about the authorship. But there are many other serious doubts.
We know of a Marlowian, don't we, in the 1830s.
There were other doubts expressed many other times, in many other modes as well. All you've got to do is read the De Vere Society newsletter. Julia Cleave's brilliant article is on the website.
John in Ashland writes, he says, this is a fascinating subject. Reportedly, Edward De Vere had 6 children throughout his lifetime that we know of, so wouldn't one or more of these children have inherited his papers and effects from which proof of authorship could be proved? Kevin?
Well, he had 3 main daughters by his first wife, Anne Cecil, who was the daughter of Lord Burleigh. And the third daughter married the Earl of Montgomery, who is one of the incomparable pair of brethren to whom the first folio is dedicated. So it's quite, well, I won't say likely, but it's certainly possible that the papers came down through her to the Earl of Montgomery. He did have a son, so the 18th Earl, but he died childless, and so the title passed over to cousins then. So we think that it's likely that it came down through the third daughter. Her works in her library went up to the largest country house in England, at Wentworth Woodhouse, and they had a terrible fire after the Second World War in 1946 when a huge library and all their papers from the families that had accrued and been brought together went up in smoke. And also the place where the ancestral home of the Earl of Oxford was in Essex, that had a big fire in the First World War, so it's likely that a lot of personal papers were lost there.
Roz, Barbara, from your perspective, I mean, it sounds like you've spent a little time looking at Marlowe and some time looking at Oxford as well. Is there a stronger case to be made for Marlowe?
I like the Marlowe case for a number of reasons, partly because Marlowe's writing record, he is a very successful writer in his own right up to the point where he's supposed to have died in a knife fight in Deptford, stabbed through the eye. He's a very interesting, dramatic character. He's kind of the person you might want to write these great works. But the interesting thing for me is that, I mean, obviously the major issue against Marlowe is supposedly he died in 1593 before a large proportion of the Shakespeare works had been written. But
said to have been written.
Said, oh yes, of course, the Oxfordians want to redate the canon. But the point is that, in fact, most scholars have real issues around his death. His death is very mysterious. It's well documented. There's an inquest. But he had, should we say, means, motive and opportunity to not actually die at this point. He was being prosecuted for heresy, atheism, blasphemy, which would have led to his imprisonment, torture and execution. He worked as a secret service agent. He was like James Bond in the, you know, doublet and hose. he had been essentially downed in the course of duty by a double agent who had put these accusations against him. It had become very high profile. And he had a very good reason to want to escape, because otherwise, you know, he would be killed. And most Orthodox scholars think that the inquest document is actually a lie. It's based on the testimony of three professional liars, two who were involved in the Secret Service. They were Marlowe's colleagues. The other one, who worked for Marlowe's friend and patron, Sir Thomas Walsingham. So there's enough doubt around his death that you can imagine. It wasn't actually so hard to fake your death in Elizabethan England as it is now, and people still do it for all kinds of reasons, to escape bad marriages, to escape debt, you know. And in those days, you didn't have DNA, you didn't have credit cards, you didn't have fingerprinting, you know, you didn't have passports in the normal way, you didn't have photographs. So you don't have to move far out of your area before no one knows what you look like. And if you actually work for the Elizabethan government, I mean, he was essentially working to protect the life of the Queen against Catholic plotters. Governments even now, you know, relocate people, give them new identities. Mm-hmm. It was actually easier to do then. But the point is that Marlowe kind of pretty much invented blank verse drama. He pretty much invented the English history play. And late Marlowe and early Shakespeare are pretty hard to tell apart, you know, even in terms of computer analysis. When you take various markers, there's a nice kind of smooth transition from the late Marlowe plays into the early Shakespeare plays. So like early Shakespeare plays like Titus Andronicus are really Marlowian in quality. And you have things like Edward II is a very nice, you know, it's a really great parallel play with, say, Richard II. You have Dr. Faustus. You know, Faustus means prosperous, fortunate. At the tail end of Shakespeare's career, you have Prospero, which also means fortunate. One says he's going to burn his books. The other says he's going to drown them. There are echoes of Marlowe all the way through the Shakespeare canon. So, I just find it really in the writing sense. I mean, I'm a writer. I write fiction. I write poetry. And I can see how you can look at the whole kind of combined Marlowe-Shakespeare canon as the development of one person.
Are there difficulties with the Oxford story for reasons of his timeline, his dates of birth and death and all that as well?
Can I take this?
Alexander, sure.
You asked a question to someone earlier. What's the main reason you go for Oxford? I'm Oxfordian as well in my general belief, and I believe that Marlowe was hanging around Oxford at some point as a younger man and contributing to some of these plays. Oxford had a scriptorium of writers around him. We seem to know that, and we don't have the hard evidence, but I'm fairly confident that Marlowe was one of them, because the circles Marlowe moved in were also the circles that Oxford was part of. If I'm asked the question, which is a slightly annoying question, but people always want just to have a headline, why do you believe Oxford? And Now, as I said, there are thousands and thousands, literally thousands of reasons to believe the Oxford case. There are 300 books saying that Oxford did it, and about 6,000 essays have been published on this matter. But if I'm just forced to draw something and put it on the top of my list, I would say the reason I'm in Oxford, the primary reason I go for Oxford, is because Oxford died in 1604, and Oxford was born in 1550. Now, that might not mean anything to some of these listeners, but if you look at the Shakespeare plays, Shakespeare was constantly taking things from books. He was reading books the whole time and putting them into his plays, and we've got huge amount of scholarship about the source of those plays. He doesn't appear to have used a single printed source after 1604. So you have to ask yourself, why? Well, what's gone on? Did he just stop reading? Did he go blind or something? Or maybe he died in 1604. Equally, at the other end, at the front end of things, we have a huge amount of evidence to show that plays like Love's Labour's Lost are based on events that were happening between 1589 and 1581. That's long before Shakespeare of Stratford comes into the picture. And they're satirising events that are going on then, very specific events. We have lots of little allusions, for instance, to Hamlet, that there seems to have been a Hamlet in 1589. Well, all the orthodox scholars say that's too early for our Shakespeare of Stratford. Oh, it must have been another play called Hamlet that the guy just copied. So now he turns into a plagiarist because they don't like the early references. And so Timon of Athens, for instance, we have a 1586 reference to a play called Timon of Athens that practically quotes a line from the Timon of Athens we have. So we got lots of evidence that these plays are much earlier. Ben Jonson seems to support that. And very, very feeble, weak evidence that anything really was being created after 1604. So I think... and Kevin is actually the world's expert on the dating of Shakespeare's plays because he has edited the absolute Bible of this, called The Dating of Shakespeare's Plays, so he knows an awful lot about it.
That would tend to put you in that category. We have a question here from, or an email here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. He says, for a stint of heresy here, considering the fact that, for example, people wrote authentic, and he uses quotes, Brahms music more than 100 years after his death, that Shakespeare's story appears in many countries and many languages independent of his work, and finally, considering that it is today's bringing his work to life, what does it matter if he ever existed, and or if he wrote his plays, had them written, was three different people, and so on? May I be forgiven, writes Wolfgang in Sunny Valley.
Well, can I just take this one, Jeff?
Sure.
Wolfgang, thank you. Great question. I think it really does matter because virtually every interpretation of any passage in Shakespeare or of a Shakespeare play depends on a biographical basis. And so people start from this. Now, if you read Charles Dickens, then the first thing you want to know is, you know, where was he when he wrote this, and what's going on around about the time, all the topical allusions. And we don't ever get this with Shakespeare. So we sort of have this vacuum that the plays are sort of just appear. They're sort of just come down from heaven. And you read this in the biographies. For his next play, he turned to writing about Hamlet. You know, and you say, well, where's this come from? You know, there's nothing in his own background. There's no reason, according to the Stratford man, why it's done. So I really do think it does make a difference as to how we appreciate and interpret. And Mark Rylance, the great actor, said, once he felt that there was a real author, and he tends to favour Bacon, he felt that there was someone actually speaking to him through these plays, and therefore he really wanted to know what this author was trying to say to him. And a lot of actors, if they don't understand something, well, they just cut it. It's too difficult, too much effort. But it does give a very different perspective.
All right, we're not going to solve it here today. We're out of time, I'm sorry. It is the Shakespeare authorship question being considered this weekend by the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship visiting Ashland for the next 4 days. A lot of these same folks will be in today's lecture at the First Presbyterian Church in Ashland at 1 this afternoon. Kevin Gilvary, chair of the De Vere Society, Alexander Waugh from the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, and Roz Barber from the Shakespeare and Authorship Trust. Thank you all so much for joining us today in the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.